Welcome to episode 45 of the Cashflow Connections podcast. The topic for today is how Eddie Lorin raises capital for affordable housing through Reg A+. As many of you know, there have been a lot of changes in securities laws since the Jobs Act 2012. One of these changes has resulted in companies being able to raise capital through non-accredited investors without going through the entire IPO process. The rule is called Reg A+, and it's relatively new to the real estate sector, but a lot of companies are utilizing it, particularly because it allows them to raise capital from non-accredited investors, and these investors simply did not have access to these type of opportunities outside the public markets otherwise. However, when you're dealing with the SEC in any capacity, they're definitely going to make it more challenging, particularly if you're raising capital from non-accredited investors. So today we're going to talk about what this whole process has been like, the costs associated with this, some of the time associated with this, as well as some of the key takeaways that he has learned going through this whole process and what he anticipates for the future. Additionally, we're going to talk about the multifamily sector as a whole. This is especially as it relates to workforce and affordable housing. This has been a reoccurring theme on the program. A lot of sponsors are exclusively focusing on workforce and affordable just because the demand is there. A lot of the economic data is coming out to suggest that that's not going anywhere, and it's really challenging to build new workforce or affordable developments. So the writing is pretty much on the wall, and that's been something that's come up a lot. Now, within that affordable space, there is an interesting conversation to be had about accepting too many tenants that require subsidized housing. From a big picture perspective, the government tends to be quite reliable in terms of providing reliable subsidies when it comes to housing in particular, but being overallocated to one payer, in this case, the government, it may have its risks as well. So this is definitely something that investors who are focused on this space should be considering. And we're also going to talk about some of the key takeaways from going through this range of dealing with institutional, ultra high net worth families to dealing with non-accredited investors who are investing amounts of $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. Also, I have some really good news about the program. We have some absolutely stellar guests coming up, which I am really excited about, and I'm sure you're going to really enjoy. Two authors, which I think have written some of the most influential business books in the last 10 years. First of all, we have Grant Cardone, Mr. 10X, Mr. Who's Got My Money, coming on the program in about a month. If you haven't found out who this guy is yet, do yourself a favor, download his audiobook, 10X. I've talked about it in the program before. It's literally the kind of book that you read and think, wow, I hope my competition never reads this book. It's extremely powerful, very straightforward, but extremely powerful. And also, we have Oren Claff, who is the author of Pitch Anything, which is essentially strategies to help people position themselves to appropriately pitch or sell their product in a way that makes your potential buyer very, very interested in your product or service. It's a very unique book. It's extremely entertaining. Even if you're not into the strategies he advocates, they may not be for everyone, but the book itself is undeniably good. So make sure you check out both of those books in preparation for these interviews. You're going to really enjoy them. All right, hope you enjoy the episode. How's it going, everyone? Our guest for today is Eddie Lorin, who has successfully purchased and transformed more than $3 billion worth of multifamily real estate, which amounts to more than 180 thriving communities with approximately 40,000 units nationwide. That's right, 40,000. He's also the co-founder of Happy Foundation, which is a nonprofit that brings educational and sustainable health, nutrition, and fitness programs directly to the doorsteps of children and families living in multifamily apartments. And I could go on and on about this guy's background. Needless to say, we're very lucky to have Eddie as a guest today. So again, thanks again for coming on.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you.
So I obviously want to talk a lot about impact housing today, what that means to you, you know, the big picture thesis, et cetera. But before we get into that, let's talk about your background. How did you really get started in real estate in the first place? And what were some of the first deals you worked on?
Well, when I got out of UCLA, I was trying to figure out, is it food, clothing, or shelter? So I tried food, not that great. Clothing, you know, I was pretty good selling clothes, but really, it was about shelter. And having grown up with no father and a mother who died at 17, I worked my way through college. I didn't have a lot of money growing up. And I always was listening to my mom, and that message was, you can be poor, but you got to be clean. And so I always kept that, you know, even if with modest means, we still worked hard and kept where we lived in a place where it was full of love and cleanliness and all those good things that make life worth living and life good. So as a result, I kind of moved toward the apartment business after going into office, retail, industrial. I really was searching a lot, having the background I had. I searched a lot in my life as to what am I good at and what can I make thrive and how can I make a difference? So eventually moved toward the apartment business because, you know, the office, industrial, retail, these are all very institutional properties and their institutional capital structures. You can't be as nimble and you can't make as much of a difference as you can in apartments. You got 1-year leases, you have flexibility, you have more autonomy. So long story short, that's where I ended up in the apartment business. And I found that I was always having to buy properties on today's value and not on tomorrow's value. So it was always a cash flow driven model. You know, we always wanted to strive to get double digit cash on cash returns, and that's the only value there is. Everyone in the world wants to do IRRs, but we never know what an IRR is going to be. In retrospect, IRRs were amazing. But going forward, maybe it's just a cash flow model. So all you have is what you have in front of you and what you can transform an asset into and what you can get your cash and cash return in. So that's the true essence of what value is in my world. So moving on to how could I make a difference, I found that neglected real estate, properties that were really in a state of disarray, were an opportunity to transform them. So we start with a sign. I want someone to go buy a sign of a 200-unit apartment building that we own and say, I only wish I could afford to live there. And lo and behold, when they go inside and see the resort-style pool, state-of-the-art fitness center, beautiful clubhouse, common areas, et cetera, and the interior appointments on the units, they really can afford to live there. And so we give workforce and lower-income people that clean, safe, affordable place to live, treat them with respect and dignity. They tend to stay, pay, and refer their friends. So that's the basic essence of our business. And that's what I strived to become good at, because looking back on when I grew up, I always wanted to make the most out of everything I had, even though I didn't have a lot. So that value needs to come to our shareholders, our investors, to our managers, and more important, to our residents. Because everyone who's under our roofs, that is thriving under our roofs, they're paying our rent. They're paying our cash flow. We need to treat them with the utmost respect, and it comes back in spades.
Sure. You mentioned a lot of things there that I definitely want to go into some detail about. So just so I understand from a big picture, does the majority of your investments, are these, where are they on the scale of things in terms of risk? Are you incorporating significant value adds? Are you buying properties that just need a little bit of rehabilitation, trying to squeeze an extra $75 per month out of rent? Where is the real place that you play in?
Mostly right there. We like to say we put in about $5,000 a unit on a garden style apartment, and $2,000 on the exterior per unit, about $3,000 on the interiors. We don't tend to over-improve, and we're looking for a $100 bump. And that's it, $50 for the exteriors and $50 for the interiors. So if average rents are $800, we're only looking to move at $900, and we're keeping it affordable because most people are still able to live there and make less than 80% of the area median income, which is our target for what this new launch is, Impact Housing, which is the crowdfunded REIT you alluded to, where anyone and everyone can invest, even non-accredited investors. So we have our first deal. I'll give you an example. It's a high-rise in Maryland. We just went hard on it. We're going to be closing in 60 days. It's 12 stories. It shares the parking lot with 48 townhomes that are individually owned and one pipe coming in, meaning one pipe of water. So the bill backs are not equitable. So one of the savings is we're going to separately meter those 48 townhomes. They're going to pay their fair share. And we're going to end up with not only savings in our expenses, but we're also going to end up cutting down the amount of gallons used. So we target a triple bottom line. First financial, then environmental in terms of saving water. In the common areas, we're going to go in and take the incandescent bulbs and make them fluorescents and LEDs. And the third bottom line is social. We're going to take a basement that's completely neglected and dilapidated, and we're going to transform it into a thriving clubhouse for our health and wellness programming and for common areas, because we find that bringing programming to where people live and their doorstep is much more effective than the YMCA or the synagogue or the church, whatever. So, you know, when people feel like there's a landlord who cares about them and wants to make a difference and create a sense of community and community gardens, it really makes for a thriving community. And that's the good essence of the chemistry or the subjectivity of it smells good in here. It feels good. I want to live here. I'm respected here. So we're all about getting the resident really happy.
You mentioned the kind of distinction there. I want to get your perspective on this. When you mentioned affordable, is that the terminology that you describe in the necessary definition of that term, in the sense of the affordable space, usually relating to some kind of government subsidies, et cetera? Or do you mean affordable in the sense of workforce housing? Or are you kind of intermingling the two terms there?
Well, I am in a separate business in the affordable housing business. That is a defined term, and it is tagged toward area median income. And yes, there are a lot of government subsidies in that part of the business. For this endeavor, I'm attempting and have been successful at making workforce housing, as you say, affordable. Now, what's the definition of affordable in the broadest sense, not in the specific sense of government subsidies? Here, with no government subsidies, the definition of affordable housing is anyone making less than 80% of area median income. So, for instance, if the area median income is 50 grand, your 80% is 40 grand, we won't rent to anybody who makes more than 40 grand a year for that two-person household. So, you know, there's specific business of affordable housing where it's called a LURA, a land use restriction, is on title. In this instance, it will not be on title, but it will certainly be affordable to most of the workforce. And that's a missing segment, because there's a lot of subsidized housing opportunities, but there are very diminishing a number of workforce opportunities that are safe and clean and wonderful.
Okay, yeah, and I appreciate the distinction there. I actually just had someone on recently to talk about development, and they were talking about how when prices increase, especially when you have cost escalation increase in areas like California and Denver at a really significant amount right now, it's very challenging to make development of anything besides luxury housing pencil. So there seems to be a legitimate constraint of supply in the markets. And that's where not only, and I mean affordable again in the broadest sense, where both workforce and affordable, it's very challenging to develop those units. So there's all this demand for the product, but you can't really increase the supply without really being aggressive with your underwriting assumptions. So it's certainly a space that a lot of people I respect are interested in right now. You know, I want to talk to you about this, the actual structure of this E-REIT that you're mentioning. I'm sure we can go into some of the details. Is this a, you know, generally speaking, is this a 5, 10, 15-year structure? What are you seeing in terms of the time horizon of this vehicle?
The docs say 5 years with 2 1-year options to extend. So it's a 7-year hold.
Okay, got it. And what are some of the underwriting assumptions that you're looking at? What is the type of deal that you say, okay, this is definitely going to make sense? I mean, you mentioned briefly the $100 in rental increase. That makes sense. What are some of the things that you look at and say, this is way out of whack, we definitely can take advantage of that there, or just some green lights in the property as a whole?
Okay, I've been in this business a long time, and now the lawyers start to give me a little bit of aggravation since we've gone through the SEC, FINRA approved. I got to be careful what I say. So our past results, we've achieved a 25 IRR on average in 72 properties we've sold, and the cash-on-cash returns are approximated almost 10% on average. Future results are not indications. You know how that goes, yeah, the whole disclaimer thing. But what's really important is we don't buy a deal until we feel that we can get to double-digit cash-on-cash returns in year 3. So, you know, whether the IRR is going to end up being a gross 20, 21, 19, 18, that's all great, and we have to look at that. But we are really just targeting cash yields and figure that the markets will hopefully take care of us because we've created enough value that even if cap rates increase a little bit, we'll still sell and make money. But we're a cash flow model.
Okay. And the IRRs just then, was that net to investors or was that at the property level?
That 25 was gross. property level on average, which is pretty darn good.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is the management. Is this something that you do in-house, or do you source management of these assets via third parties?
Absolutely. I'm a third party guy. You know, there's two sides of the coin. I have always been a value oriented guy, and I have incredible respectful relationships with many people for 20 years, and they're good at what they do in management and compliance and let's call it W-2 management, which I'm not the best at. I'm good at setting a business plan, executing that business plan, and having the vision to transform assets into thriving communities. The day-to-day management, as you buy and sell, you know, all of a sudden you've got a situation. Well, what do I do with these people? I love these people. Well, as you go in and out of a property, a market, and you find the right deals, because to me, deals drive everything. There's never a good time to do a bad deal or a bad time to do a good deal. When you go in and out of these markets, you let the people that are really good at what they do do the day-to-day, and we are the client. So we ride herd on them, and we have the chance to, you know, or the stick to fire them if they're not performing. It's just a model that works for me. And it's not to say that other people don't do really well, but you have to have a concentration of 2,000 to 3,000 units in a market before it makes sense, in my opinion, to be in that management game. But I want to be nimble. I want to be flexible. And I love what I do. And I couldn't do it if I were mired in being a management company.
Right. Certainly. And are you focused on a few key areas where you have those strategic relationships, or where are the majority of your buying taking place on a geographic location?
Well, I'll tell you where I've done business, and we currently do now. So we're all over Texas. We have very high concentration, Las Vegas, California, Florida, and the Beltway are primarily our markets. But I do have some affordable product that we've got in Chicago and New York, because they've been driven by investors that need what called CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, brownie points with the feds. So I do have a nationwide footprint. I've been in this business a long time, and I've done business in 48 states. So, you know, but primarily we tend to get the right opportunities in these sweet spots. So I have two properties under contract in Maryland. I got another one coming up in Florida. And we just bought a couple in Vegas and Dallas. So these are the markets that we focus on: in Colorado Springs, Denver.
Okay. Just, I mean, all over. And those are definitely some of the markets that we keep hearing about over and over again. So for good reason, I'm sure. In the affordable space, I assume that, is it all of the units are rent controlled, or is it just that some of the units are rent controlled?
Like everything in life, it depends.
Okay.
Every deal is different. I've got a deal in Florida and Tampa where we actually own half of its low income housing tax credits completely restricted, and the other half is fully floating at market. Others are 100% affordable, and others have 20%. It just depends. Like, I have a property in Dallas that has an RTC LORA still on from 90s, and that will be on for another 15 years. But regardless of what is on title, we have in our charter to make sure that we don't rent to anybody who makes more than 80% of AMI, regardless, in the REIT. And that's where we're targeting. So wherever the rent restrictions are based on title, that's a different story. But no one, even the market rate units, will be rented to anybody who makes more than 80% of AMI.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's talk briefly about the HUD voucher system. I know there's some changes taking place in the industry. What are your thoughts on the current state of these vouchers, and how is the industry in a shift right now?
It's so sad. I feel, and I hope I don't alienate anybody, I feel this administration is a direct assault on the working poor, and it pains me. There are so many people that are, unfortunately, have one foot on a banana peel. These vouchers are so critical. If they can afford to pay $300 and the rents are $800, that voucher is keeping them in their homes. And, you know, we're going to have a bigger problem with homeless. It's going to grow, and there's no secret why it's growing, because incomes have stagnated and rents have jumped. And if you're going to cut the voucher system, Mr. Carson, you're going to end up alienating a lot more people, and we're going to have a lot bigger problems. So I would rather not make bombs and pay for bombs. I'd rather house the working poor in this country and treat them with the respect and dignity they deserve. So there you go.
Okay. Yeah, that's concise enough. I think that obviously this definitely alludes to an interesting point, which is that with the government subsidies, you know, part of the perspective is that this is a tenant that is always going to pay their rent, right? If you have a tenant that has a government subsidy, they get the check, they then turn it over, or the check is basically deposited directly to the account, et cetera. When you're looking at affordable, obviously tenant diversification is key. So if this tenant is even a really reliable tenant, I guess to your point regarding Ben Carson, what are your thoughts on being too overexposed to these government programs that, you know, it's basically like having a single payer of rent or something like that?
Well, but median incomes are not rising enough to keep up with rents. What are people supposed to do? If you make $11 an hour and you work hard full time, and by the way, I think the people that everybody's focusing on gaming the system, maybe there's 10% that game the system. The rest are hardworking individuals. You look in their eyes and you see that they're going to work every day and they're trying to feed their families and they have the same issues that anybody else does. These are good people. 90% of them have not gaming system. So what I need, I don't see that as a subsidy. I see it as decency, because median incomes aren't going up. If you're making $11 an hour, all you should be able to pay in rent is $550 a month. Go find rent for $550 a month. What are you supposed to do, be homeless?
Right, fair enough. I guess my question was really regarding the, like as an investor's perspective, right? So the government is subsidizing, let's say 40% or 60% of the apartment units, you know, what are your thoughts on how do you calculate that in terms of being overexposed to that particular aspect of the entire investment vehicle?
I always go to 09, 010. What were the occupancies in low-income housing properties in 09 and 010 that were subsidized? 98.5% on average nationwide. The safest place to be. A defensive move. Affordable workforce housing. You're not going to get hurt. And those subsidies, unless they go away, that is a risk. I worry about that. I can't imagine, God forbid, it does go away. But yeah, that's the problem, is are these vouchers going to stay? But let me tell you, these vouchers are valuable, and these people will do everything in their power to keep those vouchers. And if they mess up, there's 1,000 people waiting in line. And that's the problem, is that they're not renewing the vouchers. So as the vouchers fall off, they're not increasing them. So it should be that someone loses a voucher, you get a voucher. But right now, they're proposing just to let them go, and that's how they're going to cut the budget.
Okay. And, you know, this is something that I kind of get a good sense of. What percentage of debt are you using for these purchases? And what does that capital stack typically look like?
Let's say it's a $10 million total cost. We will be getting $3 million of equity down and probably $7 million, 70% of cost, Freddie, Fannie, fixed rate debt. That's pretty much the formula.
What is the interest rates on those type of purchases? What do they look like?
Well, they're, you know, depending on treasuries, we would lock in right now at 4.75% with a couple years interest only, and then it would go to amortization on a 7-year basis. So after 7 years, it's due, because that's the end of our hold period, but it would be fixed for the entire term with 2 months of interest only, or IO, we call it.
Okay. And let's say one that, well, let's take two different metrics there. So the debt service coverage ratio, I guess, before the amortization starts, and then after the amortization starts, if things go according to projections, where do you think you'll be in that range in terms of debt service coverage?
We're not going to get a loan unless it's 120 underwritten today or as we close. And then we usually end up in year 5. In fact, here, I can pull up a spreadsheet now. Probably 1.7, but let me not do that until I, here we go, 1.67 in year 5 on this deal I'm looking at today, right now in front of me. So we're going from 1.2 to 1.67.
Okay, awesome. And I appreciate you kind of going to that level of detail, because obviously it's important, especially with the, you know, the current state of interest rates, which, you know, I'm definitely interested in getting perspective on. Where do you see that, you know, what are your thoughts on the current state of that situation, and where do you see that going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, who knows what a crystal ball is? That's why you got to lock in fixed rates today and hope that there's value there if rates go up. You know, we've been saying rates have been going to go up forever. You look at Japan and they can't get out of their own way with rates. I don't know, maybe 100 bips in the next 2 years. I couldn't have any clarity beyond 2 years, but I don't think that the 10-year floating around 3 could get past 4 in the next couple of years. But you never know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's geopolitical risk. Nobody knows. Everybody thought they knew in 07, 06 what would happen. I don't think we're there because we don't have over leverage going on. And, you know, it's amazing in 1 to 4 units how difficult it is just to get a loan still.
Certainly.
You know, anybody could fog a mirror in 06 and 07. So I don't think we're at risk for that. My point is that who knows?
Sure. And particularly as it relates to residential loans, you know, 4 units or less, the lending market is not loose. It'd be very challenging to make that argument. Okay. Well, I definitely appreciate that. So one of the things I really want to talk to you about is this crowdfunded REIT going through this structure. I know this is very, very challenging, onerous, and expensive. Before you entered this, you know, most of your capital was source from institutional investors. Before we go into the crowdfunded REIT thing, I definitely want to get an idea of what are some of the previous clients you used to work with or the types of clients you worked with prior to going to this e-REIT route?
Various family offices, wealth managers, the Marcus and Millichap folks, Hanover was a partner, Lubert Adler is a big opportunity fund in Philadelphia, dealt with Blackstone. And, you know, I've found that it's much easier for me to do what I do best rather than being second-guessed by the institutions. I like to go and do things that are more friends and family. And crowdfunding is an amazing opportunity to level the playing field and democratize the investment landscape so anyone and everyone can come in. So it's a very exciting opportunity, this Jobs Act, which was passed. And we're looking forward to growing this platform and making it available to worldwide investors for a minimum of $1,000. And never before has it been possible for the average person in Morocco, for instance, to invest here in institutional quality real estate that's going to make a difference and change people's lives. So we think it's a revolutionary concept. It's through the SEC was very onerous, and that's why investors should rest assured that it's more everything I say or everything we write is very, very well scrutinized. So, you know, that's great. All for it. Consumer protection. So that's the good and the bad of working with institutions. You know, you get them done quicker, but you're overexposed to one big gorilla investor and they call the shots. And from a personal standpoint, I like to feel that after all my experience, I should call the shots.
Fair enough. And I guess that the Reg A Plus is kind of the vehicle for that. So just for the listeners, there's several different kind of structures you can use to raise capital. And the most popular ones are the 506B, which we've discussed at length in the podcast previously, 506C, which allows for public solicitation. And then there's Reg A. Now, there's also something called Reg CF, but we won't go into the details of that right now. But Reg A is basically what you decide to use, which also allows public solicitation as well as non-accredited investors. So I guess my first question is, walk us through that process, what it was like dealing with the SEC, how onerous was that, you know, range of how expensive that was. I mean, this is a major hurdle for a lot of people that are putting deals together, is the cost and the admin associated with that.
Well, you know, you would think that the legal would be the most expensive, but actually the marketing is. Legal's $100,000 and going through the process of, let's call it another cost of $100,000, but then, you know, I'm like $300,000-$400,000 on top of that into marketing. Make a video. You got to put together your track record, your program. You've got to do Facebook ads and Instagram. And you know, I've been on airplane, you know, like American Airlines spots, and you know, there's the marketing. I have a marketing person. I'm an investor relations person. And so the marketing is the most important and the most expensive. But of course, getting through the SEC took us a year.
Okay.
So we started, took us a year. And then we got approved at the end of last year. And now we're just getting rolling and getting our first asset ready to close. And then another one will follow. And, it's picking up steam, but it was a slow start. And, I actually thought that it would be easier, honestly, but it's a different business. You know, I go to, and I don't understand it because I just did a deal in Vegas. We raised $5 million in a week from my investors, but to go and try to raise money, it's slower. And maybe it's the unknown. But the track record's very clearly stated on the website, and I don't have an answer for you, but we're gathering steam. We're getting 25s here and 50s there, and there's 100 there, and it's gaining steam. But the marketing is the biggest challenge, I guess, to answer your question.
Well, I think that part of what's going on is that this is relatively new. Even though the regulations have been allowed for quite some time, people are very hesitant to be the first one to be the case study, right? Especially from a legal perspective. So because of that, the mentality of the investor base, if the reason that you're putting so much into marketing is that you're actually having to educate the investor base, perhaps for the first time, particularly as it relates to non-accredited investors. So, you're basically pioneering the space. There's not a lot of major players out there that are doing this, but, one of the reasons that's the case is that the admin is challenging with dealing with a lot of potentially non-accredited investors. So what are some of the things you're doing from an administrative standpoint, whether it be technology or otherwise, that's kind of helping facilitate that?
It's CrowdStreet. That was a very significant expense. They've had us listed on the site. So they're the back engine. And then we have a company called VStock, which is stock transfer agents. So everything's done automatically, which is pretty cool. When we do a standard syndication, we have to get, everybody's percentage into our own internal documentation, and here it's all automated, and everybody will be set up based on a spreadsheet through the stock transfer. That's how they get verification that they own the stock, and they will get their quarterly distributions sent via wire transfer immediately, and we'll upload the quarterly statements. So technology is amazing, and I've been doing syndications kind of the old-fashioned way, and we're actually going to start automating that too, just to see how cool the technology and how far it's come. But you're right. The problem is nobody would ever, 10 years ago, would you ever put your online banking and send a wire online? No, you would never do that. But, there's a millennial shift. They're more comfortable. There's about $40 trillion that's going to transfer between the baby boomers and the millennials. And they're much more open to investing, not only online, but investing with a purpose. I want to emphasize what impact investing is. This next generation, and we all should be the same, wants a profit, yes, but profit with a purpose. And that's the most important thing. And you don't have to sacrifice returns to make a difference in the world. We've proven it, and many others have proven it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. You look at companies like Tom's and Thrive Market. I'm an investor in that company. That's why I bring it up so frequently. But they have a mission. They're willing to come out of pocket to facilitate that mission. But the reality is, if they're able to accomplish those missions, they usually end up being very lucrative for themselves and for the principals of the company. So I completely agree with you on that. And actually, with that in mind, let's talk about, you're obviously out, being a guest on a show, for example, you're getting in front of the PR. There's obviously another angle that can be taken from the PR side of things when, I invest in mobile home parks, so I hear this quite frequently. People can say, well, you're taking advantage, you're raising rents even though you've added value, et cetera. How do you kind of balance that from a PR standpoint?
Well, look, nobody gets a free lunch. We're not in subsidized housing. We're here to make a solid return, but at the same time make a difference in people's lives. And the extra $100 they're paying, they're happy to pay it. It's worth it. People pay for value and they're happy. and they stay, they pay, they refer their friends. So that's my answer.
Sure. That totally makes sense. And, you know, the reality is real estate investors all over the country have made so many communities much more safe by simply implementing these value add strategies, adding lights, adding security cameras, doing things like this. Of course, you have to pay for those things, but there, you know, I have seen many, many thank you notes from the properties when I used to own properties myself, residential properties, you know, thank you notes to the management companies slowly turning neighborhoods around because they're focused in particular geographic locations. So I certainly relate to that. So, you know, before I let you go, I want to ask a couple of questions, big picture stuff in terms of, you know, your perspective on business as a whole. Number one, what are some of the investors or entrepreneurs that you really get some of your inspiration from?
Well, I've had mentors in my life that have made a difference to me, and they were almost like father figures. So I always look back to them and say, you know, like, there's never a good time to do a bad deal or a bad time to do a good deal. These kind of quotes, a fellow named Stanley Black, who's still alive, and he's one I call the Beverly Hills Jewish Mafia. He was a deal guy, and he just, to me, it's go for it. And don't worry about it. If it feels right in your gut and you've done your proper homework, it'll be okay. And it always has been for him, and it has been for me using that guidance. So probably I look back to the early days when I was just learning more than I'd look at anybody today, honestly.
Yep. Obviously, that's where the influence is really most valid. What about books? Do you have any books that you've read recently or previously that you really are an advocate of?
Well, believe it or not, it's going to sound screwy, but my Bible is Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. I am a worrier by nature, which everybody who invests with me is happy to know. But, you know, at a certain point, you can't ruminate over these worries. And so I could probably show you the book at my bedside, and that's what I use primarily. But other books I've read, you know, I'm so busy reading about the trends and what's happening in each of these markets, so I don't get a lot of time to read novels. But I am doing something that's kind of unique, and that's I'm Jewish, obviously, by my references, and I'm doing something called Musar with my wife because we're empty nesters now, so we had something we wanted to do together, and we're going and learning about character traits called Musar, which is basically the concept of calmness and frugality and equanimity and, you know, just all those different traits that give us perspective in our lives and just to have us pause before we knee-jerk to the worry. So that's kind of what I'm focused on today, now that the kids are off to college and my wife and I are reestablishing our relationship.
Well, yeah, I actually haven't read that book, but I definitely will check it out.
No, it's not a book. It's a discipline. It's a discipline. It's just Musar is a discipline of traits. There's 18 of them in this, you know, that are date back to many years ago, and it's just common sense way of looking at life. So that's what it's about to me.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I'll definitely. I was just referring to the Dale Carnegie, but I definitely will. I'll check that out. Take them both out. So one last question. Then,
well, he wrote it in the 40s, you know, and it's still it's still relevant today. That's the funny thing.
Yes, all of his stuff is completely timeless. Couldn't agree more with that. One more question, and then we'll kind of close up here. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, something that you learned at a time in your life when you wish you had learned it earlier, or something that you really grew out of and took a lot away from.
Well, the biggest lesson in my life is not being overexposed to one investor. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. We had one investor who had a lot of control over us. That's why I'm telling you I want to be in control now. Because, you know, they taught you in college in your audit class, and accounting, when you're doing an audit, you always look if someone's got, like Walmart, if your only client is Walmart and you're selling them widgets and Walmart decides to stop, you know, buying from you, you're screwed. So I should have learned that lesson a lot longer ago, but we had a chemistry with a certain investor, mm-hmm. and we did a lot more deals and it became easy and the docs were done and pretty soon they own you. And so that's my biggest lesson. Don't get overexposed to anybody.
Yeah, I think that's actually great advice. And it's definitely not something that people talk about much because
Well,
most people aren't working with institutions, so they don't typically have that possibility. But I actually think that's really important, not only from an institutional perspective, but also from an investor perspective, even if you're raising money from mom and pop accredited investors. Now, the reason I say this is that if you have an investor who's over-allocated to you, they could be your biggest headache regardless of how much actual capital they have invested with you. So again, I really appreciate that feedback. And you know, just one last question. Let us know a little bit more about how investors can contact you and find more about what you do.
Well, pretty much everything I do, all the blogs, I sponsored the Social Innovation Summit at USC, and all the pictures are on the site there. So it's impacthousing.com. The blog, you can email me through there. That's the best way to get a hold of me is through that. So it's www.impacthousing.com. It's the best way to find me.
Okay. Well, I will make sure to include all that information in the show notes page. Eddie, thanks again for coming on. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thank you. Great to know you.
All right, listeners, thanks for checking out the episode. As always, the contact information for our guest will be available in the show notes page, which is hosted on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher. Don't forget, if you want access to some of the free goodies that I'm talking about at the beginning of these episodes, like free ebooks, weekly investor emails, and articles about some of the most important investment-related topics, make sure that you have created an account with CFC because this stuff is automatically available. You can do this by going to cashflowconnections.com and signing up as an accredited investor. Of course, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com. Thanks again.